This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents All We Ever Wanted by Emily Giffen. Read for you by Dorothy Dillingham Blue, Milton Bagby, and Catherine Tabor.
For Edward and George, with love and pride. Chapter 1. Nina. It started out as a typical Saturday night. And by typical, I don't mean normal in any mainstream American way. There was no grilling out with the neighbors, or going to the movies, or doing any of the things I did as a kid. It was simply typical for what we'd become since Kirk sold his software company, and we went from being comfortable to wealthy. Very wealthy. Obscene was the description my childhood best friend Julie once used. Not about us, but about Melanie, another friend. After Melanie bought herself a diamond Rolex for Mother's Day and then offhandedly remarked at one of our dinner parties that homemade pottery from her kids wasn't going to cut it. She could feed a Syrian refugee camp for an entire year with that watch, Julie had groused in my kitchen after the other guest had departed. It's obscene. I'd nodded noncommittally, hiding my own Cartier under the edge of our marble island, as I silently reassured myself with all the ways my watch, and therefore my life, were different from Melanie's. For one, I didn't buy the watch for myself on a whim. Kirk gave it to me for our 15th anniversary. For another, I had always loved when our son, Finch, made me presents and cards in his younger years, and was sad that those had become relics of the past. Most important, I don't think I ever flaunted our wealth. If anything, it embarrassed me. As a result, Julie didn't hold our money against me. She didn't know our exact worth, but had a general sense of it, especially after she'd gone house hunting with me when Kirk was too busy, helping me find our home on Belle Meade Boulevard, where we now lived. She and her husband and girls were regular guests at our lake house and our home on Nantucket, just as she happily inherited my gently used designer hand-me-downs. Occasionally, Julie would call Kirk out, though, not for being showy like Melanie, but for having elitist tendencies. A fourth-generation silver spoon Nashvillian, my husband grew up ensconced in a private school, country club world, so he'd had some practice of being a snob, even back when his money was merely old and not yet obscene. In other words, Kirk came from a good family, that elusive term that nobody ever came out and defined, yet we all knew was code for having old money and a certain well-bred, refined taste. As in, he's a Browning. My maiden name, Silver, held no such status, not even by the standards of Bristol, the town on the Tennessee-Virginia border where I grew up and Julie still lived. We were no slouches. My dad wrote for the Bristol Herald Courier, and my mom was a fourth-grade teacher. But we were squarely middle class, and our idea of living large was everyone ordering dessert at a non-chain restaurant. Looking back, I wonder if that may have explained my mom's preoccupation with money. It wasn't that she was impressed with it, but she could always tell you who had it and who did not, who was cheap and who was living beyond their means. Then again, my mom could pretty much tell you anything about anyone in Bristol. She wasn't a gossip, at least not a mean-spirited one. She was simply fascinated by other people's business, from their wealth and health to their politics and religion. Incidentally, my dad is Jewish and my mother Methodist. Live and let live is their mantra, an outlook that was passed on to both my brother, Max, and me. The two of us embracing the more attractive elements of each religion, like Santa Claus and satyrs, while punting Jewish guilt and Christian judgment. This was a good thing, especially for Max, who came out during college. My parents didn't miss a beat. If anything, they seemed more uncomfortable with Kirk's money than with my brother's sexuality, at least when we first began to date. My mother had insisted that she was just sad I wouldn't be getting back together with Teddy, my high school boyfriend, whom she adored, but I sometimes sensed a slight inferiority complex. A and her worry that the Brownings were somehow looking down on me and my family. To be fair, a half-Jewish girl from Bristol with a gay brother and no trust fund probably wasn't their first choice for their only child. Hell, I probably wasn't Kirk's first choice on paper either. But what can I say? He picked me anyway. I'd always told myself that he fell in love with my personality, with me, the same way I fell in love with him. But in the past couple of years, I had begun to wonder about both of us and what had brought us together in college. I had to admit that when discussing our relationship, Kirk often referenced my looks. He always had. So I'd be naive to think that my appearance had nothing to do with why we were together. Just as I knew, deep down, that the patina and security of a good family had, in part, attracted me to him. I hated everything about that admission. But it was definitely on my mind that Saturday night as Kirk and I took an Uber to the Hermitage Hotel for about our fifth gala of the year. We had become that couple, I remember thinking in the back of that black Lincoln Town car. The husband and wife in an Armani tux and a Dior gown who were barely speaking. Something was off in our relationship. Was it the money? Had Kirk become too obsessed with it? Had I somehow lost myself as Finch grew older and I spent less time mothering him and more time in the role of full-time philanthropist? I thought about one of my dad's recent remarks, asking why my friends and I didn't just skip the galas and give all the money to charity. My mom had chimed in that we might be able to accomplish more meaningful work in blue jeans than black tie. I had gotten defensive, reminding them that I did that sort of hands-on work too, such as the hours I spent every month answering calls on Nashville's suicide helpline. Of course, I hadn't admitted to my parents that Kirk sometimes minimized that kind of volunteering, insisting that I was better off just writing the check. In his mind, a donation of dollars always trumped time. The fact that it came with more splash and credit was beside the point. Kirk was a good man, I told myself now, as I watched him take a swallow of the bourbon roadie that he'd poured into a red Solo cup. I was being too hard on him. On both of us.
You look fabulous,
he suddenly said, looking over at me, softening me further.
That dress is incredible.
Thanks, honey, I said in a low voice.
I can't wait to take it off you,
he whispered, so the driver wouldn't hear him. He gave me a seductive look, then took another drink. I smiled, thinking that it had been a while, and resisted the urge to tell him that he might want to slow down on the booze. Kirk didn't have a drinking problem, but it was a rare night that he didn't at least catch a red wine buzz. Maybe that was it, I thought. We definitely both needed to ease up on our social calendars, be less distracted, more present. Maybe that would come when Finch went to college in the fall.
So, who have you told? About Princeton?
He asked, clearly thinking about Finch, too, and the acceptance letter he'd just received the day before. Other than my family, only Julie and Melanie, I said. What about you?
Just the guys in my foursome today, he said, rattling off the names of his usual golf buddies. I didn't want to brag, but I couldn't help myself.
His expression mirrored the way I felt, a mix of pride and disbelief. Finch was a good student and had gotten into Vanderbilt in Virginia earlier that winter. But Princeton had been a long shot, and his admittance felt like a culmination and validation of so many parenting decisions, beginning with applying Finch to Windsor Academy, the most rigorous and prestigious private school in Nashville, when he was only 5 years old. Since then, we had always prioritized our son's education, hiring private tutors when needed, exposing him to the arts, and taking him to virtually every corner of the globe. Over the past 3 summers, we had sent him on a service trip to Ecuador, to a cycling camp in France, and on a marine biology course in the Galapagos Islands. I recognized, of course, that we were at a distinct financial advantage over so many other applicants. And something about that, especially the check we'd written to Princeton's endowment, made me feel a little guilty. But I told myself that money alone couldn't gain a kid admission to the Ivy League. Finch had worked hard, and I was so proud of him. Focus on that, I told myself. Focus on the positive. Kirk was looking at his phone again, so I pulled mine out too, checking Instagram. Finch's girlfriend, Polly, had just posted a photo of the two of them, the caption reading, "We're both Tigers, y'all. Clemson and Princeton, here we come." I showed the picture to Kirk, then read aloud some of the congratulatory comments from children of our friends who would be in attendance tonight.
"Poor Polly," Kirk said. "They won't last a semester."
I wasn't sure if he meant the distance between South Carolina and New Jersey or the mere reality of young love. But I murmured my agreement, trying not to think of the condom wrapper that I'd recently found under Finch's bed. The discovery was far from a surprise, but it still made me sad, thinking of how much he had grown up and changed. He used to be such a little chatterbox, a precocious only child, regaling me with every detail of his day. There was nothing I hadn't known about him, nothing he wouldn't have shared. But with puberty came an onset of remoteness that never really cleared, and in recent months, we'd talked very little, no matter how hard I tried to break down his barriers. Kirk insisted it was normal, all part of a boy's preparation to leave the nest. "You worry too much," he always told me. I put my phone back in my bag, sighed, and said, "Are you ready for tonight?"
"Ready for what?"
he asked, draining his bourbon as we turned onto 6th Avenue. "Our speech," I said, meaning his speech, though I would be standing beside him, offering him moral support. Kirk gave me a blank stare.
"Speech? Remind me, which gal is this again?"
"I hope you're kidding."
"It's hard to keep them all straight."
I sighed and said, "The Hope Gala, honey."
"And we're hoping for what, exactly?"
he asked with a smirk. "Suicide awareness and prevention," I said. "We're being honored, remember?"
"For what?"
he asked, now starting to annoy me. "The work we did bringing mental health experts to Nashville," I said, even though we both knew it had much more to do with the $50,000 donation we'd given after a freshman at Windsor took her life last summer. It was too horrible for me to process, even all these months later.
"I'm kidding," Kirk said, as he reached out to pat my leg. "I'm ready."
I nodded, thinking that Kirk was always ready, always on, the most confident, competent man I'd ever known. A moment later, we pulled up to the hotel. A handsome young valet swung open my door, issuing a brisk welcome. "Will you be checking in tonight, madam?" he asked. I told him no, we were here for the gala. He nodded, offering me his hand, as I gathered the folds of my black lace gown and stepped onto the sidewalk. Ahead of me, I saw Melanie chatting amid a cluster of friends and acquaintances. The usual crowd. She rushed toward me, giving me air kisses and compliments. "You look amazing, too. Are those new?" I reached up to her face, my fingertips grazing the most gorgeous chandelier diamond earrings. "Newly acquired but vintage," she said. "Latest apology from you-know-who." I smiled and glanced around for her husband. "Where is Todd, anyway?"
"Scotland. Boys' golf trip, remember?"
she said, rolling her eyes. "That's right," I said, thinking that it was hard to keep up with Todd's boondoggles. He was worse than Kirk. "Will you share this fellow with me tonight?" Melanie asked with a shimmy of her shoulders as Kirk rounded the car and joined us. "I'm sure he has no objections," I said, smiling. An accomplished flirt, Kirk nodded, giving Melanie a double cheek kiss.
"You look stunning," he told her.
She smiled and thanked him, then shouted, "Oh my God, I heard the fabulous news. Princeton, you must be so over the moon proud."
"We are. Thanks, Mel. Has Beau made a final decision?"
Kirk asked, shifting the attention to Melanie's son. His friendship with Finch, going all the way back to the first grade,
was really the reason Mel and I had become so close.
"It's looking like Kentucky," Melanie said.
"Full ride?" Kirk asked.
"Half," Melanie said, beaming.
Bo was an average student, but an amazing baseball player, and had similar offers from a handful of schools.
"That's still really impressive. Good for him," Kirk said.
For years, I'd had the uncomfortable feeling that Kirk had been jealous of Bo's baseball career. He often accused Melanie and Todd of being obnoxious, bragging too much about all-star this and that. But now it was easy for Kirk to be gracious. Finch had won, after all. Princeton trumped baseball. At least, that's how I knew my husband saw it. As Melanie flitted off to greet another friend, Kirk announced that he was going to find the bar.
"Do you want a drink?"
he asked, usually quite chivalrous at the start of the evening. It was the end of the night that sometimes got iffy. "Yes, but I'll go with you," I said, determined to spend quality time together, even in a crowd. "Can we please not make it a late night?"
"Sure, that's fine," Kirk said,
slipping his arm around my waist as we walked into the glittering hotel lobby. The rest of the night followed the usual gala script, beginning with cocktails and a silent auction. There was nothing I really wanted, but reminding myself that all the money was going to a good cause, I bid on a sapphire cocktail ring. Meanwhile, I nursed a glass of Sauvignon Blanc, made small talk, and reminded Kirk not to drink too much. At some point, the dinner chime sounded, the lobby bar stopped serving, and we were herded into an expansive ballroom to find our assigned tables. Kirk and I were at a tin top, front and center, seated with three other couples we knew reasonably well, plus Melanie, who kept me more than entertained with a running critique of the decor. The floral arrangements were too high. The cuisine, chicken again, and the egregiously clashing red and maroon attire of the gala co-chairs. How could they not have thought to coordinate? Then, as an army of waiters trotted out our standard chocolate mousse desserts, the gala chairs introduced Kirk and me, heaping praise on us for our commitment to this charity and so many others. I sat up as straight as I could, feeling a bit nervous as I heard,
"So without further ado, Nina and Kirk Browning."
As the crowd applauded, Kirk and I rose and made our way to the short staircase leading up to the stage. With my hand in his, we ascended the steps, my heart pounding with a rush of adrenaline that came from being in the spotlight. When we reached the podium, Kirk stepped forward to take the microphone, while I stood at his side, pressing my shoulder blades together, a smile plastered across my face. When the applause died down, Kirk began to speak, first thanking the co-chairs, their various committees, our fellow patrons, and all the donors. He then got to the reason we were here tonight, his voice growing somber. I stared at his strong profile, thinking how handsome he was.
"My wife, Nina, and I have a son named Finch," he said. "Finch, like some of your children, will be graduating from high school in just a couple of months. In the fall, he will be headed off to college."
I looked past the bright lights into a sea of faces as Kirk continued.
"For the last 18 years, our life has revolved around him. He is the most precious thing in the world to us," he said,
then halted, looked down, and took a few seconds to continue.
"And I just can't imagine the horror of losing him."
I lowered my gaze, nodding in agreement, feeling a stab of overwhelming grief and compassion for every family devastated by suicide. But as Kirk went on to talk about the organization, my mind guiltily wandered back to our life, our son, all the opportunity that stretched ahead for him. I tuned back in to hear my husband say,
"So in closing, Nina and I are so honored to join with you in this important cause. This is a fight for all of our children. Thank you so much, and good night."
As the crowd applauded once again, and a few of our closest friends actually stood for an ovation, Kirk turned and gave me a wink. He knew he'd nailed it.
Perfect, I whispered. Only things were actually far from perfect. Because at virtually that very moment, our son was across town, making the worst decision of his life.
Chapter 2. Tom. Call it father's intuition, but I knew something bad was happening to Lila before I actually knew. Then again, maybe my gut feeling had absolutely nothing to do with intuition, or our close bond, or the fact that I'd been a single parent since she was 4 years old. Maybe it was simply the skimpy outfit she'd tried to leave the house in just hours before. I'd been cleaning the kitchen when she slinked past me wearing a dress so short you could see the bottom of her ass, a part of her anatomy that her 800 Instagram followers had come to know well, thanks to countless artsy, according to Lila, bikini shots she'd posted before I instituted my bright line social media bathing suit ban. "See you, Dad," she said with practiced nonchalance. "Whoa, whoa," I said, blocking her path to the door. "Where do you think you're going?"
"To Grace's. She just pulled up."
Lila pointed out the front window of our house.
"See?"
"What I see," I said, glancing out the window at Grace's white Jeep, "is that you're missing the bottom half of your dress." She rolled her eyes and hitched an enormous tote bag over one shoulder. I noticed she wasn't wearing any makeup. Yet. I wasn't a gambling man, but I'd bet $100 that by the time Grace's car was at Five Points, the black shit Lila put around her eyes would emerge, along with boots to replace her untied sneakers.
"It's called fashion, Dad."
"Did you borrow that fashion from Sophie?" I asked, referring to the little girl she regularly babysat. Although it might even be too short for her.
"You're hilarious," Lila deadpanned,
staring at me with one eye, the other covered with a mane of curly dark hair.
"You should do, like, stand-up."
"Okay, look, Lila, you're not going out of the house in that." I tried to keep my voice low and calm, the way a psychologist had advised we speak to our teenagers at a recent lecture at Lila's school. "They tune us out when we yell," the lady had said in her own monotone. I'd glanced around the auditorium, amazed to see so many parents taking notes. Did these people really have time to consult a notebook in the heat of the moment?
"Dad," Lila whined, "I'm just trying to go study with Grace and a couple other people."
"Studying? On a Saturday night? Seriously? What do you take me for anyway?"
"Our exams are coming up, and we have this big group project."
She unzipped her backpack and pulled out a biology textbook, holding it up as proof.
"See?"
"And just how many boys are in your study group?" She fought a smirk and lost. "Change. Now," I said, pointing down the hall toward her bedroom, my mind filled with the horrifying possibilities of the real-life biology lesson she could get in that outfit.
"Okay, but every minute I waste debating this with you is like a percentage point off my grade."
"I'll settle for a C and a longer dress," I said, then resumed my cleaning to indicate the conversation was over. I could feel her staring at me and, out of the corner of my eye, saw her turn and stomp down the hall. A few minutes later, she returned in a potato sack of a dress that only worried me more, as it confirmed that she'd be changing clothes right after she spackled on the makeup. "Remember, be home by 11, I said, even though I had no real way of enforcing her curfew when I wouldn't be back until much later than that. I was a carpenter by trade, but to make a little extra cash, I also drove a few nights a week for Uber and Lyft, and Saturday was my best night.
I'm sleeping over at Grace's, remember?"
I sighed, because I vaguely recalled giving her permission, though I had forgotten to call Grace's mother to verify the plans. I told myself that I had no reason to distrust Lila. She could be rebellious on the margins, testing the boundaries the way teenagers do. But, for the most part, she was a good kid. She was smart and studied hard, which was why she'd ended up at Windsor Academy after attending public school through the eighth grade. The transition had been difficult for us both. My challenge was around logistics. She could no longer take a bus to school. And economics. Tuition was over 30 grand a year, though fortunately more than 80% of that was covered by financial aid. Her stress had more to do with the intense academics and an even more intense social scene. In short, Lila had never before been around so many rich kids, and it had been a bit of a struggle to keep pace in their polished, privileged world. But now, nearing the end of her sophomore year, she had made a few friends and seemed happy overall. Her closest friend was Grace, a little spark plug of a girl whose dad worked in the music industry. "Are her parents home?" I asked.
"Yeah. Well, her mom is anyway. Her dad might be out of town."
"And Grace has a curfew?" I asked, feeling sure she did. I'd met her mother only a few times, but she seemed to have a good head on her shoulders, though a decision to give her 16-year-old a brand-new Jeep was, in my book, suspect.
"Yes, and it's 11:30, she said, looking smug.
11:30? For a sophomore?
"Yes, Dad. That's everyone's curfew but mine, or later."
I didn't believe this, but gave in with a sigh, having long since learned to pick my battles. "Fine, but you have to be back at Grace's by 11:30 sharp.
"Thanks, Dad,"
she said, blowing me a kiss on her way out the door, just the way she used to do when she was little. I caught it in the air and pressed it to my cheek, the second part of our old routine. But she didn't see me. She was too busy looking down at her phone. For some reason, it was that air kiss that I thought about as I returned home around 1:30 in the morning, poured a Miller Lite into a frosted mug I kept in the freezer, and heated up a plate of two-day-old chicken tetrazzini. It was the last communication I'd had with Lila, not a single text or call since. That wasn't all that unusual, especially on nights I worked late, but it still nagged at me, along with a weird feeling of unease. Nothing catastrophic or doomsday, just fear of her having sex kind of worry. A few minutes later, my phone rang. It was Lila. I felt simultaneous relief and worry as I answered and said, "Are you okay?" There was a pause before I heard another girl's voice in my ear.
"Mr. Volpe, this is Grace."
"Grace, where's Lila? Is she okay?" I asked, panicking, as I suddenly pictured my daughter in the back of an ambulance.
"Yeah, yeah. She's right here, with me, at my house."
"Is she hurt?" I asked, unable to think of another reason Lila wouldn't be calling me herself.
"No, not like that."
"Like what, then, Grace?" "Put Lila on the phone, now."
"I can't do that, Mr. Volpe. She can't really talk."
"Why can't she talk?" I said, growing increasingly frantic as I paced around our small kitchen.
"Well," Grace began, "she's kind of out of it."
I stopped pacing long enough to put my shoes back on. "What's going on? Did she take something?"
"No. Lila doesn't do drugs, Mr. Volpe,"
Grace said in a steady, firm tone that calmed me just a little. "Is your mom there?"
No, Mr. Volpe. She's out at a benefit thing, but should be back soon."
She continued to babble an explanation of her mother's social itinerary, but I cut her off. "Damn it, Grace, could you please tell me what the hell is going on?"
"Well, Lila just drank too much. Well, actually, she didn't drink that much. She only had a little bit of wine and, like, one drink at this party we went to. after we studied. But she didn't really eat dinner. I think that was the problem.
Is she conscious? I asked. My heart raced as I wondered if Grace should hang up with me and call 911.
Oh, yeah. She's not passed out. She's just really out of it. And I'm a little worried, and just thought you should know. But honestly, she didn't do any drugs or even drink that much, as far as I know. But we were apart for a little while. Not that long.
Okay, I'm on my way over, I said, grabbing my keys as I tried to remember the exact location of Grace's house. It was somewhere in Belmead, where most of the Windsor kids lived, but I dropped Lila off there only a few times. Text me your address, okay, Grace?
Okay, Mr. Volpe, I will, she said,
then resumed her disjointed mix of confessing and downplaying. Somewhere between the door and my car, I hung up on her and started to run. After retrieving a semi-conscious Lila from Grace's, Googling alcohol poisoning, and talking with Lila's on-call pediatrician, I concluded that my daughter wasn't in any immediate danger. She was just run-of-the-mill dumb teenager drunk. So there was nothing for me to do but sit with her on the tile floor of her bathroom while she moaned and cried and repeatedly slurred.
Dad, I'm so, so sorry.
Occasionally, she even referred to me as Daddy, my former name, which, sadly, she'd dropped a few years back. Of course, she was wearing the dress I'd told her not to wear, and her eyes looked like a panda's, ringed in black. I didn't bother to lecture, knowing she likely wouldn't remember anything anyway. I did ask her some questions, though, hoping that the booze would act as truth serum, and that I could get enough of the story to be able to effectively cross-examine her in the morning. The conversation was fairly predictable, going something like this. Did you do drugs? No. Did you drink? Yes. How much? Not that much. Where were you? At a party. Whose party? A boy named Bo. Does he go to Windsor? Yes. What happened? I don't remember. And that was all I got. Either she really didn't remember, or she was just telling me she didn't remember. Regardless, I was left to fill in the blanks with less than pleasant imagery. Every so often, she'd crawl back to the toilet and puke, while I held her tangled hair out of the way. When I felt sure nothing was left in her stomach, I fed her sips of water with a couple Tylenol, helped her brush her teeth and wash her face, then got her into bed, still wearing that dress. As I sat in the armchair in her room and watched her sleep, I felt waves of all the predictable anger, worry, and disappointment that come with being the father of a teenage girl who has just fucked up. But there was something else nagging at me, too. And as hard as I tried, I couldn't stop myself from thinking of Beatrice, the only other person I'd ever taken care of like this.
Chapter 3. Nina. Of all people, it had to be Kathy Parker to tell me what Finch had done. In my younger years, I had the occasional frenemy, a girl who found a way to ruffle my feathers and bring out the worst in me. But in my adult life, Kathy was the closest, really the only thing I'd ever had to a nemesis. On the surface, we were friendly, sharing a social circle, frequenting the same country club, and attending the same parties and girls' trips. But secretly, I couldn't stand her, and I got more than occasional clues that she felt the same way about me. Kathy, who came from old Nashville money like Kirk, always seemed to be looking for ways to take me down a notch. One tactic she enjoyed was to subtly reference my background, asking random questions about Bristol or my family, particularly in front of other people. This was, I believe, her way of insinuating that, notwithstanding my in-laws, I, personally, would always be,
New Nashville. I'd actually heard her use the ridiculous term before. She was also the master of the backhanded compliment in the bless your heart vein. She would say things to me such as, I love your dress. I have a wonderful seamstress who could raise that hem a touch for you. Or, after peering into the back seat of my car in the parking lot following a spin class, goodness, I wish I were as laid back as you when it comes to clutter. Which could be directly followed by, you're so lucky you sweat the way you do. It gets out all the toxins. Melanie told me to take it as a compliment. Her theory was that with the sale of Kirk's company, I had usurped Kathy's status as Queen Bee of Nashville's social elite. I have no desire to be Queen Bee of anything. Besides, you can't be the Queen Bee if you're from Bristol, I said. You can if you marry Kirk Browning, Melanie said. He's got it all, compared to Hunter for sure. I shrugged, thinking of Kathy's husband. Like Kirk, Hunter was from the landed gentry of Nashville, but he was rumored to have burned through a lot of their family money on bad deals. She also resents your looks, Melanie said in her usual blunt way. You're richer and prettier, younger too. I laughed her comment off, but couldn't help thinking that the richer part really did correlate with an increase in Kathy's jabs. More than that, though, I think Kathy knew that I saw through her two-faced Bible-beating bullshit. To be clear, I have no problem with religion or people who are religious, even those who are outspoken about their faith. What I can't stand are the judgmental hypocrites. People who talk a big Christian game, yet don't even make a cursory attempt to follow the golden rule, let alone some of those pesky commandments. In a Schadenfreude nutshell, Kathy not only thrived on the misfortune of others, but used tragedies as opportunities to showcase her devoutness. Something bad would happen, and she'd be first on the scene, offering prayers on Facebook, dropping off a casserole, or calling a special session of her Bible study group, which was as exclusive an invite as one to a garden party at Buckingham Palace. Perhaps that's part of why she viewed it as an affront that I always declined to join. To be fair, I'm sure that some of Kathy's prayers were sincere, certainly in matters of life or death. But I truly believed she relished the smaller emotional setbacks of others, and even occasionally rooted for someone's marriage to fail or kid to screw up. So she really hit the jackpot the night of the Hope Gala, when she found me in the ladies' room. Oh, hello there, Nina, she said in her high, fake voice, joining me sink-side. We made eye contact in the mirror and smiled at each other as I continued to touch up my makeup. You look so lovely tonight. Lovely was her favorite word, and one I had actually excised from my vocabulary as a result. You too. Congrats on the Italy trip, I said, because she had just outbid Melanie during the live auction to win 2 first-class airline tickets to Rome and a week's stay at a Tuscan villa. Thank you, hon. Melanie wasn't too upset, was she? She asked, her voice revealing her insincerity. Oh, no, not at all, I lied out of loyalty to Melanie, who had been infuriated by Kathy's smug paddle raising. I think she was secretly relieved not to win it. Todd hates when she bids on trips. Yes, she said, nodding. I've heard he's rather tight. Oh, it's not that. It's just those annoying blackout dates, I said, walking the line between being an outright bitch and simply raining on her parade, feeling transparent and maybe a little guilty for stooping to her level. I added a chipper footnote. Of course, Tuscany's lovely any time of year. Yes, it is, she said breezily. Besides, I was bidding more for the charity than the trip itself. Certainly, I said, noticing, not for the first time, how seldom she blinked. It made her big, wide-spaced eyes even more irritating. Meanwhile, she gave me a look so grave that I had no real choice but to ask what was wrong. She inhaled deeply, pressing her palms together while she glanced up at the ceiling as if gathering strength.
Oh, dear, do you not know?
Her voice trailed off. I knew her pretense to compassion well, and that the charade was simply a precursor to gossip. Perhaps someone had passed out at the dinner table, or was dancing inappropriately with someone else's spouse, or had debuted a bad boob job. There was plenty of fodder to work with at any gala. Don't know what, I asked, against my better judgment. She winced, pursed her lips, then drew another amazingly slow breath.
Finch's Snapchat, she whispered on the exhale,
with a fleeting but unmistakable expression of glee. My heart sank, but I told myself to remain strong, resist her entrapment, say nothing. So that's what I did, simply staring at my own reflection, brushing an additional layer of gloss over my lipstick. It was clear that my silence both confused and frustrated her, and it took her a few seconds to find her footing.
You obviously haven't seen...
No, I don't have Snapchat, I said, seizing a slice of the moral high ground that comes with opting out of any form of social media. She let out a little laugh.
Well, good heavens, I don't either. And even if I did, it wasn't on his story. Apparently he sent the photo to his friends.
Then how did you see it? I asked, putting my gloss back in my bag. Someone took a screenshot, and it spread like wildfire. Lucinda sent it to me a few minutes ago, during Kirk's speech, actually.
But don't worry, she won't share it further. She's very discreet when it comes to these sorts of things, and we've been strict with her about appropriate usage of social media.
That's so kind of her, I said, thinking of Kathy's daughter, Lucinda, and how she shared her mother's meddling tendencies. My mind raced with possibilities. What could Finch possibly have texted that could warrant all of this drama? Perhaps he'd bragged a bit too much about Princeton, or maybe he was drinking a beer in celebration. I reminded myself to consider the source, that this was vintage Kathy, stirring the pot so she could look superior, then play savior. But I still caved, turning away from the mirror and staring directly into her bug eyes. So, what was in the photo, Kathy?
It was a photo of a girl. She quickly replied, lowering her voice to a loud whisper, likely hoping that people were eavesdropping.
And so, I said, trying to remain unflappable.
So, she began, so, the girl was basically naked.
What? Naked? I said, crossing my arms in disbelief. There was no way, no chance. Finch would ever do something so stupid. Everyone knew that that was 101 on how to get thrown out of Windsor, right up there with stealing.
Well, half naked anyway.
I bit my lower lip, now envisioning a lingerie-clad model, or perhaps a risque photo of Polly, who could be known to dress a bit provocatively, but no worse than many of the other girls.
Well, I said, turning again toward the door, kids will do that.
Kathy cut me off.
Nina, she was passed out. On a bed.
Who is this she? I snapped.
Her name is Lila. I guess she's a sophomore at Windsor. Hispanic girl. Maybe you should see it.
She whipped her phone out of her Chanel bag and pulled up her text messages, an image filling her screen. She held it out for me to see. I took a deep breath and looked down. At first glance, all I saw was a girl lying on her back on a bed, mostly dressed, or at least far from naked, and I felt a small wave of relief. But as I peered more closely, I saw the details. Her little black dress hitched both up and down, as if someone had tried unsuccessfully to yank it off, or haphazardly put it back on. Her thighs slightly apart, her calves dangling over the foot of the bed, her bare feet not quite touching the floor. and her left breast spilling out of a bra, nipple and all. There were other details, too, less jarring than the girl herself, though somehow still disturbing. The dingy clutter of a teen boy's bedroom, a tan comforter, a nightstand covered with beer bottles and crumpled tissues, a poster of a band I didn't recognize, its members grungy, menacing, tattooed. And very strangely, a green Uno card in the girl's left hand, her fingers curled around it, her nails painted crimson. I took a few breaths, trying to remain calm, hoping that there was some explanation, that at the very least, this image had nothing to do with Finch.
"Did you read the caption?" Kathy asked, still holding the phone in front of my face.
I looked down again, squinting at the photo, this time seeing Finch's name, as well as the words that were typed onto the image, blending in with the comforter. I read them, hearing Finch's voice.
"Looks like she got a green card."
My heart sank as any defense of my child melted away.
"I'm sorry," Kathy said,
slowly pulling her phone away from me, then stowing it in her bag.
"I especially hate that this happened on a night when you and Kirk are being honored. I just thought you should know."
"Thank you," I said. And as much as I wanted to shoot the messenger or slap her across the face, I knew that Kathy was no longer the point. "I have to go now. I need to get back to Kirk."
"Of course you do," she whispered somberly, giving me a pat on the arm. "Bless your heart, Nina. I'll be praying for y'all."
Within 30 minutes, Kirk and I were home, and I'd received the image from two other friends, including a hysterical Melanie, who recognized her son's bedroom and was racing home herself.
"What in the world was he thinking?" I asked, as Kirk and I stood on either side of the island in our kitchen.
"I can't imagine," Kirk said, shaking his head. "Maybe it was a dumb inside joke."
"An inside racist joke?" I said, a fresh wave of despair washing over me.
"Well, it's not really racist per se," Kirk said.
"Seriously? Green card? It's totally racist. Kathy said she's Hispanic," I said.
"Well, she really doesn't look Hispanic. She just looks like a brunette. Italian, maybe."
I stared at him a beat and shook my head, unsure how to even respond to this.
"Kathy doesn't know everything," Kirk said, reaching for the bottle of whiskey he'd left on the counter.
I pushed it away from him.
"Okay, look, Kirk. Even if she's not Hispanic, his comment is still offensive and racist toward Hispanics," I said, my voice steadily rising. "And regardless of this girl's race or ethnicity, her nipple is showing. So if he did this, joke or not..."
"Then he's in trouble," Kirk said. "Obviously. But maybe there's more to the story."
"Such as?" I said.
"I don't know. Maybe someone took his phone. Maybe it's a doctored screenshot. I have no idea, Nina, but try to calm down. We'll get to the bottom of it soon enough."
I nodded and took a deep breath. But before I could reply, we heard the front door open, followed by Finch's footsteps in the foyer.
"We're in the kitchen," I called out. "Can you come here, please?"
A second later, our son appeared wearing a light blue t-shirt and khaki shorts. His wavy blonde hair looked messier than usual, and his whole appearance suddenly seemed to be cultivated, preppy sloppy.
"Hey,"
he said, heading straight for the refrigerator with only a glance our way. He opened it and stared inside for several seconds before pulling out a bag of sliced roast beef. He peeled off a few pieces, then tossed the bag back in and pushed the door shut with his elbow.
"Aren't you going to make a sandwich?" I asked.
"Too much trouble," Finch said.
"How about a plate?" I said, anger bubbling inside of me. "Can you at least put that on a plate?"
He shook his head, grabbed a paper towel from the roll, then headed for the family room, stuffing roast beef in his mouth as he went.
"Where are you going?" I called out after him.
"To watch TV," he replied without looking back.
Come back here, please, I said, circling the counter to stand alongside Kirk. Dad and I need to talk to you. I glanced at Kirk, who wore a casual expression as he drummed his fingers on the edge of the counter. I nudged him with my elbow and made a mean face.
Listen to your mother, Finch, he said. We want to talk.
Finch turned around, looking more confused than worried, as I wondered how much he'd had to drink.
What's going on?
He said, putting the last of the roast beef in his mouth and talking as he chewed. Will you please come here and sit down? I said, pointing to one of the bar stools. Finch did as I asked, but wore an expression of defiance. How was your night? I said. He shrugged and replied that it was fine. What did you do?
Went over to Beau's.
Did he have a party? I asked.
No, not a party. He just had some people over.
Why? What's with the third degree? I elbowed Kirk again, and he issued a perfunctory, don't talk to your mother like that. Finch mumbled, sorry, as he ran his hand through his hair. I waited for him to look back at me before I asked my next question. Were you drinking? I said, uncertain of what I wanted the answer to be. Would that make it better or worse?
Yeah, Finch said. I had a few beers.
How many? I asked, wishing that Kirk and I had been stricter about drinking. We'd never come out and given him our permission to consume alcohol, but we had looked the other way on a beer here and there. It was, after all, while we allowed him unlimited spending on Uber.
I didn't really count, he said. Maybe three or four.
That's too many, I said.
I didn't drive.
Well, isn't that great, I said. You deserve a medal. Finch heaved a sigh and said,
Why are you so pissed off, Mom? You know I drank.
We're both very, very upset, Finch. But it's not just about the drinking, I said, then took a deep breath, pulled my phone out of my purse, and found the image saved to my camera roll. I slid it across the counter and watched him look down at it.
Where'd you get that?
He asked. My heart sank.
Mrs. Parker showed it to Mom at our event tonight, Kirk replied.
Finch glanced at me as I nodded. Yeah, so let that one sink in. But honestly, is that really what you're worried about here? Where I got it?
I was just wondering, Finch said.
I took a breath and said, Did you take it?
Mom, it's a long story, and it's not as bad as it looks. I bet she wouldn't even be that mad.
Who is she?
Just some girl, he said.
I turned the words over in my head, feeling absolutely sickened.
Does this girl have a name? I asked him. Yeah, it's Lila Volpe. Why?
Why?
Because you posted a photo of her half-naked, Finch. That's why, I said, feeling myself become hysterical.
It wasn't posted. It just got sent to a few people, and she wasn't half-naked, Mom.
I saw her nipple, Finch, I said. That counts as naked to me.
Well, it's not like I took her clothes off.
Well, that's a relief, I said, my voice dripping with sarcasm, because that would make it assault.
Assault?
Come on, Mom, you're overreacting, he said with a weary sigh. Nobody assaulted her. She drank too much and passed out. That's not my problem.
On the contrary, son, this is your problem, Kirk said, as if the gravity of the situation was finally setting in for him. Many people have seen this photo. It's out there.
And green card, Finch? Really? I said.
It was just a joke, Mom.
It's racist, I said.
You took a photo of a half-naked girl who was passed out and then made a racist joke about her.
I'm sorry, he said, lowering his eyes and voice.
That you did it? Or that you got caught? I asked.
Come on, Mom, please. Stop. I'm really sorry.
What were you thinking? I mean, actually, what was going through your mind? I said.
Finch shrugged.
Nothing.
Nothing? Nothing? I said, floored by his answer, though maybe it was better than if he had set out to hurt someone. Still, the result was the same. The injury wasn't any less. When he didn't reply, I got more upset.
How could you do this, Finch? I just don't get it. It's so cruel. This is not the way your father and I have raised you.
And beyond that, do you realize what you've risked here? Kirk asked, finally raising his voice, too. How stupid and irresponsible this was. You could be expelled.
Come on, Dad, that's crazy, Finch said.
No, it's not, I said. It's not far-fetched at all, actually. Hell, forget Windsor. You could be sued in court.
On what grounds? Kirk asked me, as if I were a legal expert.
I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, I said, my voice rising. Defamation? Child pornography?
Pornography? Come on, Mom, Finch said.
Yeah, this is hardly a porno, Kirk chimed in. Porn, Kirk, I said. They dropped the O 2 decades ago.
Yes, because that's the important point here, Kirk said under his breath.
Look, there's enough here to bring a lawsuit, I said. I am certain of that. Bottom line, this girl and her parents could always claim emotional distress.
Mom, there's no emotional distress, Finch said.
There's not? I asked. Incredulous. How would you know? Did you ask her? Do you care about her feelings at all?
She'll be fine, Mom. This kind of thing happens all the time.
Happens? It doesn't just happen. You did it. I started to rant again.
Kirk held up his hand and said, Look, it's not about the girl.
It's not? I said. What's it about then, Kirk? Enlighten me.
Kirk cleared his throat. This is about his shitty judgment. He turned his gaze to Finch and said, Son, you showed terrible judgment tonight that could jeopardize your future. You really have to think.
Not just think. You have to feel, too, I said, cutting Kirk off. You can't treat people like this.
I don't, Mom. It was just a lapse of judgment. Kirk finished for him.
Well, unfortunately, it's not that simple, I said. Because deep down, I knew that even if every person out there deleted the picture from their phones, and Lila and her parents and the administration of Windsor never caught wind of it, and Finch truly was sorry, everything had still changed. At least for one of us it had.
Chapter 4. Tom. I'll never forget the first moment I laid eyes on Beatrice. I was sitting in a dive bar in Five Points, back when East Nashville had not yet become a hipster hangout, and had all been a dive. My dive. It wasn't the kind of spot you'd expect to see a beautiful girl, especially all alone. But she walked in solo, which was kind of alluring in and of itself. She happened to also be my type, with dark hair and eyes, bronzed skin, plenty of curves. The tight red dress didn't hurt her cause either. "Don't even think about it," I said to my buddy John without averting my gaze. John laughed. "Who? The J-Lo-looking one?" I said, "Yeah, her." "Why? Did you fuck her?" John asked, chewing on a straw, watching her as she approached us. He was the kind of loud, good-looking guy that hot girls gravitated toward, especially in bars late at night. "No, but I'm gonna try," I said with a laugh. "And then I might marry her." John laughed. "Yeah, okay," he said, hopping off his stool. He slapped me on the back, and when she was within earshot, he added, "Good luck with that, buddy." She glanced at him, then smiled at me, clearly aware of why he thought luck was needed.
"May I?"
she asked, gesturing to the now free stool. "Yes," I said, catching a whiff of her hair. It smelled like that suntan oil girls slathered on themselves. Coconut, I guess.